to the N to the FTR. I'm fucking the Republic, meeting people where they are. Left, right, center, make you laugh, make you cry. Max brings the heat of a basic white guy.
That's me.
Could've run for office, could've got up off his ass.
Hey.
Could've made something other than a fucking podcast. But here we are, yo, the UNFPR show. Many faces ripping the script with unfuckers around the globe.
And Brittany brings it back for Tom McGovern, let's go.
I'm fuckers on Canuckers, you're a fuckers 99.
Dying.
I'm the fuckers and some fuckers, they all like they fucking mind. From New York to Outagami, Halifax to New Zealand. Say it loud, say it with me,
yo, fuck Milton Friedman.
Welcome to part two in our series, Over the Borderline. In part one, we spoke with Marlene Galaz from the New York Immigration Coalition about the influx of migrants into New York City and the pressure it's placed on city agencies. In today's episode, we head to the border and below to examine the root causes and circumstances that factor into immigration patterns, from economic opportunity to asylum. Max speaks with Maureen Meyer from the Washington Office on Latin America, known as WOLA, a D.C.-based organization that advocates for human rights in the Americas. Ms. Meyer serves as WOLA's vice president for programs, working with senior staff to develop policy priorities and strategies to advance human rights and social justice in Latin America. We're still following the blended episodic and phone-a-friend approach for this series, so Max begins with a brief discussion about the complex nature of immigration policy and the historical relationship between the United States and Latin America.
And as you know, we're in our spring fun, friend, and Hellraiser period, so any support you can give would be greatly appreciated. Just go to unftr.com/memberships to check out our membership tiers and how to get involved. As always, we'd like to thank our over-caffeinated members for their unwavering support of our work. Alfie and Flash, Asshole, Bree X, Brian VAZ, Cindy S, David MJ, Eric Wagner 101, Goat in memory of Para Harl Udison, Glenn, G Wookie of Ohio, Jason, Cringy, Leanne R., Marco F., Maria from PR, Matthew, Michelle H., and Nathan E.
Nathan Sirst, Nettie Hugger 1, PDX Squatch, Pete M., Rob Nasby, Rodrigo G., Sherman Dreadnought, Sloppy Joe, Snail Powered, Sultan, Terry C., The Younger PDX Squatch, Todd J., Video Angelix, W. Jeremy D., and the memory of Nettie McGee.
Without further ado, let's get on with the show.
UNFTR.
They're sending prisoners, murderers, drug dealers, mental patients, and terrorists, the worst they have in every country, all over the world. This isn't just in South America. They're coming from the Congo, from Yemen, from Somalia, from Syria. They come from all over the world, China. Many of them are military age, which is a very strange. You don't see very many women coming in, and you see a lot of them coming in about 19 to 25, 26 years old, and especially from China. We have 29,000 over the last few months, 29,000 from China, and they all seem to be perfectly fit for military service, ready for military service. It's crazy. This is country changing, it's country threatening, and it's country wrecking. They have wrecked our country.
This morning, I was listening to WNYC's new feature called Suds and Civics, where the host talks politics with New Yorkers in laundromats to find out what's on people's minds. Today, they were talking immigration, and the two people they interviewed perfectly encapsulated the complexity of this issue, and their conversations serve as a useful bridge from our first episode that centered on New York City. So the first conversation was with a Colombian woman who migrated several years ago to the U.S., In Spanish, she expressed her admiration for Donald Trump and said there were too many new people trying to get into the U.S. And the next interview was with a Salvadoran woman who lamented the way that migrants were denigrated in the national media. The point is, immigrants aren't monolithic, and neither are the countries that they come from. From economic policies and political parties to the individuals and families they impact, it's impossible and even irresponsible to reduce the immigration narrative to bumper sticker terms like open borders, migrant crime, and catch and release. For example, here's a twist most people probably haven't considered. A former White House economist named Ernie Tedeschi published a report recently that found the post-pandemic influx of immigration responsible for at least 20% of the increase in U.S. GDP. But wait, it gets better. Another Brookings report claims that the surge in migrant workers actually helped close the hiring gap, which in turn likely helps suppress inflationary pressures. So essentially, more people filling low-wage jobs and curtailing the need to increase wages. Now, taken together, these economists are essentially saying that one of the key reasons we have outperformed the entire world in terms of reining in inflation and growing GDP figures is the increase in immigration. So there's a lot to unpack here. There's also a lot for both sides of the political aisle to like and hate about these proclamations. I mean, if you're a Republican, you hate that immigrants are contributing to growth, but you have to love the access to cheap labor domestically. It's a dirty little secret. And if you're a Democrat, it's the ultimate double-edged sword. On the one hand, the Biden administration looks completely disorganized on border policy, and that's biting them in the ass right now. On the other hand, if immigrant workers are helping to cool inflation and lead to a faster recovery, then, well, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. It's not like Biden can take to the podium and say, "I know they're undocumented, but at least you get to abuse their labor and spread their low wages around on consumer products." I mean, it's a bad look all around. This is just one of the complicating factors the major political parties are running up against or running with, depending upon the strategy to win the election. In any normal off-election year, the volume of migrant activity would be of grave concern. It's unmanageable in the best of circumstances, and we haven't exactly created anything remotely close to the best circumstances. In fact, our immigration policy is so fundamentally flawed, it's hard to envision anything but a complete reimagining of the process having any sort of impact. But in typical American fashion, we only focus on the optics and the obvious. Of course, there's a much bigger part of this story, and that's the stories of the migrants themselves and the countries they're fleeing. Sure, there are passing references to root causes of migration, and some news outlets will go the extra mile to contextualize what's occurring below the southern border. But inevitably, the more regional and immediate sensationalism wins the prime slot at the top of the hour. Now, this may come as a surprise, but the people coming across the border are coming from countries that have been around for a long time. They're real places with their own economies, political economies, cultures, traditions, and values. And they're not coming here because the streets are fucking paved with gold. I mean, sure, some are coming for opportunistic reasons to better their financial circumstances, but many are just coming to be with family that's already here. Or they're fleeing persecution, environmental disasters, political instability, or even life-threatening danger. Every asylum seeker, every migrant worker, every family, every individual has a story, and every country of origin does as well. Moreover, the United States isn't always the end game. Sometimes it's just a stop on a journey. Maybe they were turned away from their first choice. I mean, there are countries in Latin America that have a much larger surge in immigration for all the same reasons. But it's not like us to look past ourselves to ask what's actually happening in other places, and that's fair. I mean, that's human nature, and it's certainly American nature. So this isn't an attempt to chastise or criticize our collective myopia on this issue. It's an attempt to contextualize the issue so that we can take a wider and clearer view of the root causes of immigration and better position ourselves to find solutions and restore some balance to the conversation. Isolating immigration to simply a border crisis story robs us of the ability to view the tributaries that flow from it. Scratch the surface, and you'll get to political and economic policies that have a very broad impact, ours and those of our neighbors and partners.
Climate change, neoliberal economic policies, affordable housing shortages,
labor and taxes, human trafficking, exploitation and wage theft,
welfare and criminal justice reform, foreign policy, trade agreements,
industrialization, mining, fossil fuel extraction, agriculture, deforestation,
drug cartels and criminal syndicates.
The list goes on and on, but at its core, immigration is a human story. Why would someone risk life and limb to uproot themselves or their families to take part in a wholly unfamiliar culture? I mean, ask yourself, what could happen in your life that would prompt you to leave behind all that you've ever known? Language, music, culture, work, loved ones, the food you love and the streets you know? The answer is likely found in the multitude of life-altering issues we just listed. Maybe one of them, perhaps a confluence. To understand the nature of migration, it's important to use a shared language, to level set on definitions and a little history, as we do. The goal today is to set the table from a political and policy perspective. Then, in the third installment, we'll talk about economic trends and models that undergird the larger narrative. In a way, we're working backwards from our New York City immigration episode and how an influx of migrants challenged a proud sanctuary city and brought what is typically considered a border story to the streets of the most famous city in the world. A situation that pit governors and states against one another and forced the gateway to the New World, the proud home to the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island, to confront uncomfortable realities. Realities that bent social services but didn't buckle them. Realities that have tested the moral and ethical resolve of one of the most diverse communities on the planet, but haven't broken its spirit. So let's level set with a little Q&A.
Where are people coming from?
All right, so the largest inflow to the United States through ports of entry, as reported by the Customs and Border Protection Agency, or the CBP, remains Mexico. In 2023, the number of encounters, and we'll talk about that word in a moment, with Mexican immigrants was 717,000. That's close to, but still greater than, the total number of encounters from what's referred to as the Northern Triangle in Central America. That's Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. A handful of others for context. We have Venezuela at 266,000, Colombia at 160,000, Cuba at a surprising 142,000, Nicaragua, 99,000, and Haiti and Peru each with 76,000. Other countries made up about 389,000 for a total of 2.4 million, quote, encounters. Now, importantly, the term encounters is a little opaque, and I don't want to get lost in the weeds here, but it is important to briefly explore what this means. These are people who have a documented interaction with Border Patrol. Hold that thought. There's obviously another subset of migrants that evade authorities and do not self-report at the border. Now, liberal media likes to overlook this, while it's all conservative media tends to harp on. But because we have robust census data, boots on the ground with agencies that service undocumented people, and technology to track movement, we know that the percentage of purely illegal crossings are far lower than these so-called encounters. Now, another aspect of the counting here is that there are those who make multiple attempts for a variety of reasons. So people who present at the border and then will re-present maybe one, maybe two, maybe a handful of times, and they're all being counted in these figures. And we'll dig a little bit more into that in our interview today. And this is on top of what officials estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 million undocumented people living in the United States in some sort of citizenship limbo.
How is it that we have so much information on border crossings?
This is actually an interesting question that itself dismantles some of the primary talking points about the crisis. So if you casually digest mainstream media, it's easy to come away with the impression that waves of humanity have toppled fences and are storming the country with guns, knives, and bats and have ill intent toward us.
Ah, right, like the Patriots on January 6th.
Yeah, sort of like that. Listen, this happens in certain areas. There are people undertaking incredibly dangerous journeys to cross the border illegally and undetected. But again, we have a lot more information from census data and technology that paints a very different picture. The vast majority of migrants are presenting themselves to Border Patrol agents and applying for asylum. And that is entirely legal. What's different today is that they register through what's called the CBP One app, which has a website companion that immigrants can use to register with the federal government. According to the Immigration Council, quote, CBP One users must provide email addresses, create passwords, and, in some cases, enter phone numbers to create their login.gov accounts. Once users have created their login.gov profiles, they can enter information into the app and access its different functions based upon each user's particular needs, end quote. So, the rollout of this app went about as smoothly as Obama's healthcare exchange rollout. And that's the least problematic part of the program, which we'll get into later. But this is how we have so much data and information on asylum seekers, their whereabouts, and their application status. The important takeaway here is that most people aren't trying to hide from the government or sneak across the border. In other words, they're following the legal pathways of migration. The whole notion of illegal immigration is really a tired trope at this point. The United States is an asylum nation with very specific rules and decades of precedent that most immigrants are abiding by. So when you're in a discussion with someone who says,
I don't mind immigrants. I just think they should come here legally. That's what they're doing.
How does Title 42 explain the difference between Trump and Biden's approach to the border?
So this is a really meaty topic. Title 42 is an old provision dating all the way back to 1944 that basically allows the government to expel someone who has recently been to a country where there was a communicable disease or an outbreak or some concern like that. The Trump administration enacted it at the start of the pandemic, really for the first time, which seriously curtailed the number of people entering the country. It remained in force for the first 2 years of the Biden administration, even as COVID testing became available at the border. But enforcement was gradually eased on a case-by-case basis. For example, Biden crafted an exclusion to Title 42 for Ukrainians seeking asylum at the beginning of the Russian war in Ukraine. Alternately, Biden also weaponized Title 42 to expel Venezuelans to Mexico for a brief period, though he was very heavily criticized for it. The provision was lifted in May of 2023, right around the time that CBP-1 was publicly released. The confluence of a shaky app rollout, the lifting of Title 42, and a worsening of the situation in Venezuela caused the unprecedented surge in asylum seekers in 2023 that put border towns and the Biden administration in a really tight spot. According to Human Rights Watch, quote, over 440,000 Venezuelans crossed the Darien Gap between January 2022 and October of 2023, end quote. According to the Migration Policy Institute, the post-Title 42 era has significantly altered the reality on the ground. Quote, in lifting the Title 42 public health order that permitted nearly 3 million expulsions over slightly more than 3 years, the administration issued an innovative set of policies seeking to discourage irregular crossings and encourage scheduled entries at ports of entry, using the CBP-1 app to schedule an appointment. This carrot-and-stick approach, which includes a rule that presumes people ineligible for asylum if they cross the border illegally, is part of a new chapter in border enforcement, a strategy to disincentivize irregular crossings while incentivizing orderly arrivals by creating or expanding access to legal pathways. These pathways include new and expanded immigration parole programs for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans, permitting temporary stays in the United States and access to work authorization for more than 240,000 people to date. Applicants must have a U.S. sponsor and apply outside of the country for authorization to present themselves at a port of entry in the U.S. interior, end quote. So there's a lot there, and we're going to talk more about this in our interview with Maureen Meyer from WOLA. But I find it fascinating how little of this context makes it into the public discourse. Like so many other Biden initiatives, there's a ton of movement on policy and people who are extremely committed to trying, failing, and adjusting. But the numbers belie the effort. And maybe so much so that it will contribute to Biden's undoing in November. Now, lastly, before we dig into our discussion with Maureen, I think it's important to speak briefly to what's happening in the countries of origin. We're going to unpack some historical whys and wherefores in the next episode, especially from an economic and trade perspective. But from a purely political standpoint, you know, it takes two to tango. The political factors that shape migration decisions in Venezuela are wholly separate from the countries that comprise the Northern Triangle, for example. And even within those three nations, there are vastly different political circumstances. Take El Salvador. We've spoken about Bukele at length already and how his heavy-handed war on local gangs has severely curtailed the number of people looking to flee the country. But is all what it seems? The Bukele effect has spread to South America now, with President Noboa of Ecuador taking a page out of Bukele's book. Now, there's a terrific piece in The Baffler that describes the Ecuadorian predicament that led Noboa down this path. Quote, between 2009 and 2017, there was a reorganization of the cocaine trade that made Ecuador's ports the principal point of departure for the drug, both for Mexican cartels shipping to the United States and for Albanian cartels selling in Europe. The principal organized crime groups in Ecuador were born in the 1990s as common street gangs. But in the early 2000s, when large international cartels landed in the country and money laundering was facilitated by the dollarization of the economy, they began to specialize in protecting kingpins and trafficking drugs under the aegis of the cartels. The piece continues by noting, quote, The shadow of Nayib Bukele is hovering over Ecuador as over all of Latin America, as a harbinger of stable and lasting political hegemony, and Noboa is betting on it, end quote. Now in Argentina, hyperinflation and consistent fiscal mismanagement paved the way for Javier Milei and his wildly libertarian worldview. How that ends is anyone's guess, but whatever Argentina was doing before sure wasn't working. Of course, there's the political turbulence in Big Brother Brazil that mirrored the January 6th fiasco in the United States, except that they actually pressed charges against Bolsonaro for trying to overthrow the government instead of giving him a chance to run it again. Anyway, the reemergence of Lula, though a more pragmatic and corporatist Lula thus far, has led to a realignment with democratic socialist Xiomara Castro in Honduras, who herself reestablished ties with Venezuela. So things are constantly moving, and the point of this isn't to name drop and fact dump, but to reveal the vast differences between political parties and issues in Latin America. And that doesn't even touch on the Caribbean nations such as Haiti and Cuba that together accounted for more than 200,000 encounters at the border. Now, when you consider the population size and the difficult journey from island nations to the southern border, this is an astonishing figure. Now, to break this all down further and provide some incredible insight, I sat with Maureen Meyer from WOLA. Maureen is an absolute encyclopedia and really helped clarify both U.S. policy in the LAC region and the conditions within the LAC nations. Maureen, thank you so much for joining us today on UNFTR. We appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
So I found it interesting that the roots of WOLA actually can be found in something that we've covered before, which is the original 9/11, the Chilean coup in 1973. This is primarily a socioeconomic show, and we do a lot of work talking about the neoliberal experiment over the last 50 years and the results of that. Particularly through the work of the Chicago School of Economics and how that has impacted foreign policy, domestic policy, et cetera. So I think it's just an interesting place for us to start to talk about the roots of WOLA and how you how the organization kind of got involved as the bridge to Washington for the LAC nation. So if you could just kind of give us a little bit of the origin story and backstory to WOLA, that would be great.
Sure. And actually, we are celebrating, obviously, our 50th anniversary because the 50th anniversary of the coup was last September 11th. And that, as you said, led to the origins of WOLA, in part because there were, in this case, religious workers, you know, volunteers and others in Chile at the time who saw firsthand the impact of the coup on human rights, on their friends in Chile, and realized pretty quickly the impact of the U.S. support for the Pinochet regime was not getting to U.S. policymakers in terms of what that meant for human rights. So the massive abuses that we saw in the aftermath of the coup in terms of disappearances, torture, executions, and the U.S. role in all of that, and the U.S. active support for the Pinochet regime and other military dictatorships that started, you know, that were flourishing in parts of Latin America at the time. So WOLA was really created to serve, to work with partners in the region and bring those concerns and those policy proposals to U.S. policymakers here between the U.S. Congress and the administration. And that's clearly evolved in the years between, you know, the Central America decade in the 80s of war and the U.S. supporting and training death squads to, you know, I would say more recent years, which is much more on the war on drugs and the impact of security cooperation in different countries in Latin America, but certainly really looking to work with partners in the region to bring their voices, their concerns, their priorities to our government here.
But it seems like in your role as well, and I'm looking specifically at some of your writings and some of the interviews that you've done, that you actually have a focus within those countries as well. So it seems to be more than just advocacy with, you know, like a glorified lobbying organization in D.C. to bring forward the causes of LAC nations. But you're actually doing work on the ground in Latin America. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, and I think none of our work is really just WOLA on our own. We rely a lot on partnerships with local human rights organizations, local activists, academics, different actors, to really influence and inform what we do. We do travel quite frequently to Latin American countries to meet with partners on the ground to do, in the case of migration, field research. So looking at border regions and understanding what those dynamics look like, talking to migrants and asylum seekers themselves, and then bringing that information to the US government, but also to how we do our research and advocacy. And so I think that is somewhat unique that we really ground our work on partnerships and what people on the ground are telling us about what they're seeing and how we can bring them to actually speak sometimes to US policymakers here in DC.
You know, as an aside, I always find it fascinating to see the work that NGOs are doing in lieu of what you would imagine governments are doing. Like the reason that I got to you actually is because we interviewed Marlene Galaz from the New York Immigration Coalition, I believe it is. And she is a big fan of your work and the interviews that you've given, because you're able to really contextualize the migrant crisis from a way that impacts the work that they do. And so you see this sort of cascading nature of partnerships to carry communication, but also maybe streamline policy to help people get on board. And that's stuff that we normally think that, you know, that's, these are, this is just government activity and people aren't involved in it. But it really does take so much to try and coordinate efforts to represent such a significant part of the world. So in the work that you do, what's interesting about the time that we're in right now, and I'm curious about how you and your organization are viewing the migration crisis, the border crisis. Are you surprised at the level of attention that it is getting in this election cycle? Is this different in some way than your experience?
I think certainly it's gotten, I would say, an unprecedented level of attention, and the media feeds into that, right? Of like, how do you frame what is happening at the border, including calling it a crisis? It's really not a crisis as much as administrative challenge of how can the U.S. more effectively process people coming and provide them with, you know, pathways to find shelter in the United States, to connect them to where they want to go. So it doesn't look like you're overwhelming a local government or a local border community, for example. So I think the media certainly has played a role in that. I mean, the reality is there is a significant number of people that have been crossing into the United States in record numbers. And not only that, but from countries that wouldn't be considered traditional migration. And I think that's important to look at in terms of how much migration flows have changed since we started this work in maybe 2010. Which was at the time, high levels of migration, but mostly Mexican migration, and primarily for economic reasons, and mostly single individuals, single male, women, you know, people coming here either for work or for family reunification, right? People that have been deported from the United States and trying to desperately get back to their loved ones in the country. And what we've seen since then is, you know, 2012, 13, 14, a real shift to having high levels of migration from Central America. We can remember the unaccompanied migrants that started to come, you know, also for family reunification reasons. Their parents had fled the civil wars in Central America earlier and are now trying to bring their children here to be with them. To what we see now, which is, yes, a significant number of Mexicans and Central American migrants from Northern Central America coming, but also migrants from throughout the hemisphere, Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba, Ecuador, Nicaragua, you could name many others, and, you know, a number of what you can term extracontinental migrants, migrants from Africa, Asia, Central Europe. We met someone on the border in Honduras from Uzbekistan, and I think from a lot of nationalities that are starting to use Latin America as a route to get to the United States and then present themselves at the border, mostly requesting protection.
Do you consider it a crisis?
I think it is something that needs to be managed better, but I don't think we would term it a crisis. If there's a crisis in the United States on immigration, it's that the system is broken, that there has not been the investment that we need to create a more effective system that can go through the backlog of almost 3 million pending cases. And that looks at this not just from a migration point of view, but also how do you support people that, you know, want to reunite with their families here or to address the labor needs that the United States has. And so I think it's not necessarily a crisis as much as not having the resources and then not allocating and prioritizing the resources necessary to address it that way, and let alone the fact that we still have, you know, 10, 11 million undocumented people in the United States that have not had any real discussion of comprehensive immigration reform in Congress for over a decade.
So I'm glad you made a distinction between the patterns of migration and the rationale for migration over the decades, because I think that there's a great level of confusion about the reasons, and we'll talk about root causes in a moment, because I think that's an important piece of certainly what the Biden administration is attempting to address, for better or for worse, with shortcomings here and there. But when we talk about the reasons and the pathways for migration, people coming to this country, can you sort of give a very general framework and an understanding for people about, I guess, how people get registered at the border, CBP-1, the different avenues for registering people? Because if you're just a casual observer of media, I think the feeling is there are certain parts of the border that are just wide open and hundreds of thousands of people are just streaming across and we have no idea where they went to, which is really not the case. There is actually a system in place, and I imagine that people are getting through that haven't actually gone through a process and are untraced and untracked. But is it the case that the preponderance of people that come in are actually known?
I think for what we know, yes. I mean, if you look at CBP numbers, those numbers that they release every month are the numbers of known encounters, now they call them, of people that they have encountered, either who have presented themselves at the ports of entry or who turn themselves into Border Patrol somewhere in the desert in Arizona or, you know, brushland in Texas. So people that are actively approaching U.S. agents to ask for asylum in these cases in the United States. And so I think, what does this look like on the Mexican side? And I think it is still somewhat chaotic, maybe not chaotic, I mean, disorganized and with a huge backlog. So if you look at the current policy, which the one legal way for an asylum seeker to come to the United States is mostly through getting lucky and having the ability to make an appointment through the CBP-1 app, which has been known to be very flawed in terms of facial recognition, particularly for African migrants, but language barriers. If you don't speak Spanish, English, or Creole, you're sort of out of luck, or hopefully you can find a service provider that can help you make the appointment, and hopefully you have a good enough phone to make the appointment. So if you are lucky enough to get an appointment, there's only 1,450 appointments available every day. So you're thinking the number of people coming wanting to seek protection in the United States certainly does not match that
Maureen,
number.
What do these appointments look like? What happens? Who are they speaking with?
You're in an app. It's an application, a smartphone on your phone that you process. You put your photo, everything. And then if you're lucky, you get that day an appointment and it says you need to, you know, present yourself at the port of entry 6 months from now sometimes. To enter the United States. The application, the app on the phones work anywhere from Mexico City northward. So you can't be in Central America and make an appointment. You have to be at least in Mexico City. With the idea of geolocation, the phone knows where you are. So that would be the right way currently. But what that means is that if you can't get an appointment or you feel you can't be waiting 6 months in very dangerous, oftentimes Mexican border towns, for example, we just issued a report on the high level of kidnappings in Nuevo Laredo, for example, in Tamaulipas, which is bordering Brownsville, Texas. I mean, there is, there's a lot of challenges for people. So what happens is the other sort of ways people decide to cross. One, you may approach a port of entry and get an exception, get paroled in with a level of coordination between Mexican authorities and the U.S., particularly vulnerable groups. So that's like another venue. It's also a wait list. People wait to try to, desperately get in without making the application appointment, either because they couldn't or they can't wait. Medical emergencies, particularly vulnerable populations. Or, and I think this is what we see when you look at these images of, oh my gosh, so many people are coming to the border, are people that couldn't really afford to wait, or who smugglers have, directed people to cross in between the desert, for example, in the San Diego sector in California or the Arizona desert. And so you have people that are in oftentimes remote areas being directed to cross and then waiting in the cold at this point, in the summer, be in the heat, for a Border Patrol agent to pick them up. And that's where they would be saying, I want to ask protection. Because I think it's important to just, you know, clarify, requesting asylum is a right that people have. So you're not trying to come in here illegally and game the system. You are exercising your right that's in international law and US law to request asylum. And that right doesn't say you have to cross at, you have to cross legally into the United States. In fact, some of the legal challenges from previous attempts from the Trump administration to restrict access to asylum at the border said, you know, it is, you can't prohibit people from crossing irregularly to request asylum. And so I think that is where you have people, you know, desperately trying to get to the United States. And yes, a very overwhelmed system once they get to the US side of the border, because there are high numbers of people crossing, and particularly in these remote areas where you don't have as much infrastructure to support them.
So when we think about executive authority, and we think about how the different administrations have treated the treated migration across the southern border, the, I guess, so we have Title 42 is an important piece of the puzzle from the pandemic forward, right? So we have under Title 42, which I don't know when that existed or when that was created, but I assume it's a very old provision in the law. You're allowed to expel people under what is deemed to be a health crisis in the country of origin. The Title 42 has been extended, though, it seems. Like, can you tell people exactly what Title 42 is, what it did under the Trump administration, and then how the Biden administration interpreted it and either maintained pieces of it or has not?
So Title 42 was, I think you're right, it's a public health restriction that was, I think, 1942, predates, you know, many decades, that was put into place in March 2020 from the Trump administration at the onset of the pandemic as a way to limit who could come into the country and enabled the U.S. to basically expel, in most cases, back to Mexico, individuals seeking asylum because... Under the guise of it's a public health crisis, we can do this. And so that meant that, contrary to what we saw with what was previous to that, which was the migrant protection protocols, you may remember that the Trump administration and started with a way to meter almost like coming into the United States. So you could come in, request asylum, and then you were sent back to Mexico to wait for your immigration hearings. So what the MPP did was give you a pathway, very limited, to request asylum in the United States, but you had to wait in Mexico for your immigration hearings, which could mean a couple hearings back and forth, and where we saw multiple cases of kidnappings and other, you know, risks and crimes against the asylum seekers that were waiting. Title 42 pretty much almost eliminated the ability to ask for asylum as compared to the MPP, because it was just rapidly expelling people without processing them. So you were being sent back to Mexico, and that could mean you could just try again and keep trying and hopefully get through, but also really restricted who could access asylum. And so then you saw, you know, who would be able to access were particularly vulnerable groups that would approach a port of entry in coordination, again, with local service providers, government officials to come in. And I think what also happened, which was a system which was accepting people and processing them based more on nationality than any protection need. So who was being returned under Title 42 based on agreements with the Mexican government were Mexicans, because that's, you can just send them back home, and citizens of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Also high numbers of people crossing, but where they were, you know, getting quickly sent back to Mexican border towns, at times actually flown all the way back to southern Mexico without being processed and then invited to be self-deported back to, you know, Guatemala or elsewhere. And so who was admitted were people from other nationalities, farther away places, or where the U.S. had real restrictions on returning people, which included particularly Venezuelans, Cubans, Nicaraguans, countries who either don't have relations with the United States or accept very few return flights. And so Title 42 created this sort of mixed system where there were lots of limits on people from certain nationalities from coming in, and where others were being admitted because there was because of other complications that the Biden administration was facing. Title 42 was ended finally last year and replaced by the CBP, actually 2 years ago. Sorry, thinking dates, it gets always a long time for these things to happen. Replaced by the CBP One app, which was then deemed to be, this is the right way to do it. And if you don't do that and you do cross in between, it's sometimes harder for you to qualify for protection because the screening is stricter and there could be more restrictions on you being able to, you know, proceed with an immigration hearing in the United States. So all of these have really meant to, in the end, restrict how many people are coming, either based on quickly expelling everybody or certain nationalities, or just making it sort of a wait that is so long that people get desperate and, you know, either try to cross undetected, take very dangerous routes, or, you know, some of them are actually, you know, staying in Mexico or deciding to just wait it out and see if there's any changes in U.S. policy. So it hasn't really been effective. And what we've seen is all of these policies have really resulted in grave harm to migrants and asylum seekers, either denying them the ability to ask for protection. You can hear multiple times Mexicans being told by U.S. agents, Mexicans don't qualify for asylum. Asylum doesn't exist for you, to, you know, being subject to brutal crimes while you're waiting in Mexico.
I guess we'll stay on Mexico. I was going to, I was thinking that we would finish up with it because I feel like we don't talk enough about what's happening in Mexico politically, economically, in terms of crime syndicates that are there, the challenges that Mexico faces. And we're going to be talking a lot more about that, I believe, next week when we talk about foreign direct investment and some of the opportunities, some of the missed opportunities that Mexico has had over the past couple of decades to basically increase infrastructure, organization, reduce corruption, have a better system of industrialization that would provide different levels of employment. So we're going to hit that, I think, a little bit more from an economic perspective. But from a political perspective, we have a number of listeners in Mexico, and there are mixed feelings about Obrador. In most of our people come from a left viewpoint. So I think that they see Obrador favorably, recognize that he's in a rather difficult position with the big brother up north and our political circumstances that have been unusual, to say the least, over the past decade. So when Mexico looks to create policies and effectuate policy over a long period of time, when you have the neighbor up north who's really completely chaotic in terms of our relationship with Mexico right now, how is the Mexican government interpreting this moment and this crisis, and what is it trying to do from a political standpoint to absorb the influx, to curb the migration routes, and to curb the social justice issues that are impacting so many of the people that are flooding in, but then they're also their citizens themselves? What's the political moment like for Obrador?
I would say, in the most part, doing what the U.S. is asking them to do on immigration. And you can see that, you know, clearly in the past few months, where if you look at just, you know, what happened in December at the, you know, the border, and you mentioned that, you know, the scenes of, you know, large numbers of migrants crossing, border communities feeling overwhelmed with high numbers of crossing, to have a post-Christmas visit of two secretaries, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Homeland Security, and other top officials to Mexico, I think December 27th, of let's talk more about how we can work on migration, and then seeing Mexico have, I would say, historic numbers of detentions, apprehensions. He went over to about over 100,000 for the month of February, and January, February, or February, March, I need to think about the numbers. Historic numbers of, that's like what you would used to see in Mexico as a year of, you know, encounters with migrants. So Mexico stepped up and, you know, really dropped who's at least arriving at the U.S. border, which is interesting too, because if you look at the numbers of people crossing the Darien Gap through Panama, who are the numbers the Honduran government reports, because they keep pretty good track of who's going through their country. There's more people crossing than are arriving at the US-Mexico border, which suggests a lot of people are pretty much being bottled up and bussed around different parts of Mexico. That's the past few months. But I think we can even look over the past decade, from when President Obama asked Mexican President Peña Nieto, do more to work with us to stop migration or reduce the levels of migration coming to the border, that the Mexican government has continuously worked with the U.S. to stem the flow of people coming to the United States. This could mean between the Southern Border Program, which Peña Nieto did, to López Obrador's decision to deploy the National Guard, the newly created military security force, to Mexico's southern border, after a meeting with U.S. officials, which was, you know, in the context of the Trump administration threatening Mexico with tariffs if they didn't do more to stop migrants from coming up to the border. And so you could deploy massively, you know, soldiers basically to your southern border, to, you know, the current policies, which has one accepted a lot of people from non-Mexicans to be returned back to Mexico, to kind of containing a lot of people in Mexico. And so I think the primary policy of the Mexican government has been to work with the United States on this for probably two reasons. One, there are, you know, members of the Mexican Foreign Ministry's office and others that believe that having harsher policies and having, you know, the idea that you can get sent back to Mexico even if you're not a Mexican, you know, all these different things, or that it's, you know, pretty dangerous to get to the border, might deter more people from coming, which it hasn't really been the case.
Right.
And the second is, what does Mexico get out of this? And what they've gotten is a lot of U.S. continuing to work with them on other areas of priority, including on migration. You know, López Obrador had wanted to invest more in central Mexico, southern Mexico, on, you know, economic projects. The U.S. and Development Agency, USAID, is now working with the Mexican Development Agency on that, but also U.S. silence on other big issues in Mexico. So you can be concerned about, you know, the withering away of checks and balances on executive power in Mexico, the proposed attack on judicial independence, on the court system, on the electoral system, and the U.S. either silent on that, or, you know, you look at press reports that have been saying Mexico is a vibrant democracy. So certainly, you know, not wanting to criticize that in Mexico, and even more so not criticizing the militarization that we've seen in Mexico under López Obrador, who has, beyond the creation of the National Guard, basically dismantled any federal civilian police force in the country and relied on the military for part of the immigration enforcement, but also infrastructure projects and many other civilian tasks. And U.S. officials who are asked repeatedly, aren't you concerned about the expansion of Mexico's military role in Mexico, will avoid the question or talk about how important their cooperation is with the military.
So is there a rift between our understanding of what the Mexican administration has done on from a social democracy perspective and social programs versus how it is beginning to behave on the military side of things? Is it taking a hardline militaristic stance in some of the executive authority, but still continuing to do the on the ground social programs that really benefit people? Or, like, what is your impression of the political situation currently there?
I think López Obrador certainly has promoted different economic programs on, you know, raising the minimum wage, on different subsidies that are meant to support, you know, economic development or support young people so they could, you know, hopefully not work in organized criminal organizations, but really have an apprenticeship or a different career. So certainly an important discourse on addressing poverty and inequality in Mexico, and also certain programs that I think still need to measure the impact that they've had. But yes, the flip side is there has been a significant expansion of the role of the Mexican military in not just public security, but anything from airport administration. If you arrive at the airport in Mexico City, who may be checking your immigration papers are the Mexican Marines. They're in charge of security there. They've built development banks. They're sort of the go-to agency for any of the president's infrastructure projects. And so I think the broader concern there is, one, on security, having the military tasks with policing tasks sometimes can lead to incidents of excessive use of force, extrajudicial killings, to, you know, a history within the Mexican military of committing human rights violations with impunity. And so I think there's a lot of concern on the human rights side of the military's role. But on the other is, if you dismantle so many domestic institutions between your customs agency to airport administration, et cetera, how do you rebuild that later? Mm. And are you giving, you know, the armed forces too much power?
Are you surprised at this turn of events down there?
I think most organizations would be surprised of how during Lopez's administration, he's really relied more and more on the military as a candidate who came in saying, we need to return the military to its barracks. And now that is very far from being the case. And he's even, you know, tried to reform the Constitution to solidify the armed forces' role in security, to give the army basically control over the National Guard. So really, I think surprising given where he was as a candidate, not surprising given how much we've seen in the past 6 years, this growing role that the military has been given during his government.
So that's a really great bridge to talk about something that has become kind of a fascination of mine, which I'm calling kind of the Bukele effect all throughout Latin America. So I'm in a part of the country in New York where we have mostly, I would say, Central American migration. So if we have if there are migrant workers in the community, certainly that I live in, typically from El Salvador and Honduras, primarily Guatemala as well. So the very classic Northern Triangle type of migration into the area of New York that I'm in. And so I, every day, I'm talking to people just because I'm that weird person that asks them about, you know, what do you think of Bukele? And they're like, why are you even bringing this up to me, white guy? That's a very strange question. I imagine the lens that they're looking through is different than other parts of the country, but also different from people native to El Salvador. But right now, the feeling toward Bukele is so unbelievably positive. Like he is some sort of deity, because everything has changed. Everything is better. Can't wait to go home. I can talk to my family. My family is, they take walks in the park now. The economic circumstances haven't really turned around, but just that Maslow's hierarchy of need, that feeling of safety has returned to El Salvador. And now we see Noboa maybe borrowing a page from that and starting to say, okay, I need to clamp down. I need to get control of security concerns first and foremost, or because that everything flows from that. And so one of the things that I've been trying to wrap my brain around right now is from a leftist perspective, which is what we are, from a somebody who favors social democracy policies, I know it can work if we look at the Morales miracle in Bolivia. If we look at, you know, the experiments in an isolated case, we know that these type of policies can work. They can be really beneficial for people. You can achieve both safety and economic security and social justice if you have policies that are good. But then you have areas that have spun completely out of control with, and I think it's fair to characterize El Salvador as a place that was largely insecure, that had tremendous security concerns, and the population was constantly under threat or felt under threat. What is the balance? Because my fear now, Maureen, is that like Bukele is setting an extreme example and being seen as a success, not just by Trump acolytes in this country, but by other neighboring LAC nations that are saying, oh, okay, well, I guess that's going to have to be the path of resistance now, because that's what people are demanding of me. And I'm only going to stay in power if I act similarly. And so is there the potential of a domino theory in Latin American countries where you see that extreme example of strength coming from somebody like Bukele inspiring other nations and the people of those nations to vote out, you know, maybe more favorable governments from a leftist perspective and starting to bring in more authoritarian governments like a Milei in Argentina?
I think, you know, overall, and just you just mentioned Milei, right, is what you're seeing is populations that are willing to elect leaders that are mostly undemocratic or certainly made lots of undemocratic either statements or, in Bukele's case, maneuvers, including unconstitutionally running for president again, because they're satisfying some of their basic needs that they felt, you know, democracy was failing to deliver on them, for example. I think there's a lot to still unpack about the Bukele model. We did a very interesting podcast, my colleague Adam Isaacson did a great interview with Doug Farah, who's a former journalist and security expert, on like let's unpack what the Bukele model is. And we've also written about, you know, why this shouldn't be a model for Ecuador. I think some important things just to, you know, top line, homicides started dropping in El Salvador before Bukele was even president. So, you know, we have to take that into consideration. And both Bukele and his predecessors had, one of the main reasons violence had dramatically dropped beforehand was they were negotiating with the gangs. And even the U.S. government, there's, you know, DOJ sanctions on Bukele officials for, you know, proven evidence of how they were negotiating with and working with gang members.
That said, I did see that. But I also had a lot of trouble verifying that what was really going on there, because it seemed to me that it was, the rumors are that the Bukele administration is negotiating with the gangs and that there was some sort of detente in place there before the mass incarceration movement. But I was unable to really kind of verify that. So I wonder if you could just stay on that for a minute.
So, I mean, obviously the U.S. doesn't issue sanctions lately. And, you know, and so I think there was a lot of intelligence and information that would show that top Bukele officials were working with gang leaders. El Faro, which is a El Salvador originally based investigative journalism outlet, that's actually had to leave the country fiscally. Now they operate fiscally out of Costa Rica because of repression in El Salvador and attacks against them by Bukele, but have done a lot. They have recordings of some officials talking to gang members. And so there's a lot of, I think, evidence of this. But the other is, as homicide rates are going down, you know, what prompted the state of exception declaration in March 2 years ago was just a huge, you know, rash of killings in a few days, in part with the understanding that some of those agreements had been broken. So there's a lot of like looking at what was the violence actually like prior to the state of exception to what it is currently. It's undoubtable that people feel safer in El Salvador. And we hear that as well. And we hear that even from US officials in terms of, you know, their ability to travel in the country as well. That's true. What it's been at the cost of is human rights in terms of any due process guarantees for the people that are being detained. So, you know, there's over 77,000 people in mass, you know, prisons in El Salvador that are going
through. Can't even begin to imagine the conditions.
And who have, there's, you know, cases of torture. There have people, I can't remember the number of how many people have died in custody. It's over 100 cases of torture, mistreatment, lack of food. Families are basically having to bring in most of the food to support their loved ones. A lot of allegations of, you know, arbitrary detentions, people just getting picked up, young people, because they had tattoos and, oh, you must be a gang member. There's so much to unpack of like why this has been risky. And a lot of family members that I think, you know, really, you know, very clear that these people, you know, have nothing to do with gangs and they're innocent. And there's no chance to really prove that in a lot of cases. But the other is, El Salvador's economic challenges currently. There is a huge increase in food scarcity, or like, you know, people unable to access basic needs. Bukele's experiment with Bitcoin hasn't gone as he had hoped to, and a lot of concern of massive corruption within his government. If you look at even the discussions of whether El Salvador is going to qualify for a new IMF loan, which they've been negotiating for 2 years, in part it's out of concern, not about the human rights democracy part, as much as good governance, lack of transparency, how much the Bukele administration has dismantled the fiscal transparency, public access to information, the anti-corruption mechanisms that existed previously are not there. So a lot of, you know, concerns about the situation in El Salvador. But I think the reality is, too, that there needs to be different policy proposals out there of how can you control a very dire security situation in the short to medium term, and that does show results for a population without leading to these mass arrests and declarations of terrorism, or, I mean, Noboa's case as well, he declared the 22 criminal groups as terrorist organizations and sort of a, beyond a state of exception, a state of conflict or war in his country. So it's a real concern. I think there the challenge is sometimes there's not the short-term quick solutions. What you can say, and what we know, I've been working on Mexico for two decades. I think that the biggest challenge is how do you, in the short term, if you're going to deploy your security forces, for example, and if you're going to look at like mass detentions, for example, how do you pair that with the longer term institutional reforms you need
right.
to have better effective police, a more effective judicial system that actually prosecutes the people responsible for crimes, and a government that's free from corruption. And so I think there's a lot that still needs to be discussed about this. You can't model what happened in El Salvador with Ecuador, even by the sheer size of the country and the dynamics of groups. Ecuador has transnational criminal organizations working with local gangs. They're from Mexico, they're from Colombia, they're from Albania, working with Ecuadorian groups. El Salvador is a gang situation, which most of its profits came from local extortion, right? So even just the scenario is different, the size of the countries are different. Sadly, though, the impact on human rights could be the same, which is more and more willingness to disregard human rights concerns or democratic norms or due process guarantees in the name of providing safety. That's not sustainable in the long term.
I think one of the things I was responding to, this is a few weeks ago, but when Bukele came and spoke at CPAC, these are soft metrics, but I was like, oh, that's interesting. Okay, let me go and check who else was on the slate and who else spoke at it. And went across the board, a lot of the usual suspects. Bukele's numbers, just on YouTube alone, for how many people went in and viewed it, were staggering. The reception that he received was so outsized for the role that he plays in the world. And it's I guess it got me thinking about like, okay, if we are to have Trump 2.0, there's no question that there will be a cozying up to that authoritarian style leadership where the administration... I could see that a next Trump administration essentially punting on any of the work that is being done and saying, no, we're just going to encourage everybody to do what the Bukele model, because that's how we stem the tide of immigration. We want people to stay right where they are. How do we do that? Make them feel safe in their own countries. And so we're going to just export more arms to these countries. Forget humanitarian need. They already want to rip USAID apart anyway. So I could just... It feels like that's the potential crisis that isn't being spoken about, that our diplomatic war machine funding stance could change on a dime. And all of any of the work that's being done right now could be uprooted in a matter of minutes if they just simply say, here's a bunch of weapons, go do what that guy did. Is that too hyperbolic to think that way?
Two parts of that. One, the role of Congress, right? So, in the next
we do have a Congress. You're right.
Could
you're right.
do, lots of things they want to do. In part, depends on, who Congress continues to control the purse, right? So how much they get funding for it or how much Congress decides to allocate funding, that they view as their own priorities. And so we'll have to see what that composition looks like. We did a series at the end of the Trump administration on what has been the impact of that government on human rights and democracy in Latin America. And I think it made clear that because the administration had stepped away from having human rights and democracy as a center point of US policy and was much more of transactional nature and really, gave the blank check to governments that were free to talk about, criticizing the press as being fake news, to if you look at Guatemala's case, for example, during the Trump administration, the International Commission to Combat Impunity in Guatemala, which had been working for almost a decade with the Guatemalan prosecutors to go after high-level corruption cases, including organized criminal groups, government corruption, former President Pérez Molina and Vice President Valletti and others. That was, in a sense, dismantled in part because the U.S. stepped back and wasn't pushing on Guatemala to keep it in place anymore. And it's like, well, that's, your sovereign decision. And yes, also Guatemala transferred its embassy in Israel to Tel Aviv. So they did things that the U.S., viewed as favorably. So I think what you saw was there is a damage when you have a U.S. presidency that doesn't have, at a minimum, willingness to address human rights and democracy concerns. And it allows some of these anti-democratic forces to to grow. And I mean, Guatemala is probably the best test case of that, because you saw after the CICIG was dismantled, the persecution of justice operators, former CICIG officials, over 30 went into exile, mostly in the United States, because they were going to get put in jail for working on corruption cases in their home country. And to now, you know, how long, how hard it was for President Arevalo, who's the current president of Guatemala, to actually even take office in January, because right. there have been so many efforts by, you know, the hidden powers and Pacto de Corruptos, corrupt pact in Guatemala, to make sure that he couldn't take office. So I think there is a lot of concern of what that could mean in terms of both human rights, democracy, but as you mentioned, you know, the authoritarian tendencies of governments who have the same playbook in terms of how they interact, how they behave. Milei, President Milei, was also at CPAC. And there's a lot of the same advisors that they all work together. And we are seeing definitely a democratic backsliding in Latin America. Guatemala is probably the exception right now to what we've seen elsewhere. That is concerning in terms of respect for human rights, respect for the rule of law, and how to rebuild at some point, you know, democratic support for democracy in a region that's very much less supportive of democracy, because it really failed in many cases to address their basic needs, from security to economic development.
You know, it seems that there's almost like, or maybe you can actually help frame it for me. I feel like there's almost no in between in Latin American countries I don't know, is it fair to say like the post-World War II dictator model that it sort of came out of, like in the democratic era of the LAC broadly, that it seems that it's either pushing, that countries are either pushing really hard one way for social democracy, or they just tend to fall into authoritarianism. And I know that's painting it with, it's not a monolith, it's painting it with a broad brushstroke, but are there any examples of moderate governance consistent over time that is sort of like steady, set it and forget it kind of democracy that is building in a very stable way? Is that Brazil with the taking Bolsonaro out of the mix?
Even with Brazil, I think Bolsonarismo is still very present. You know, talking to Brazilian colleagues, they're very, you know, they sort of aware that, you know, President Lula is president now, but it's not like those forces are not still around. But I think it does show that you can have a return to having a peaceful, more or less, transition of power, although they also had, you know, the January 8th sort of incursion into Brazil's Capitol building.
Copycats.
But
it's your own insurrection.
Yeah. I think, you know, interestingly, because of the this 50th anniversary, we've been a lot of discussion with the Chilean government and the Chilean ambassador. President Boric was actually here last fall in the context of another anniversary, which was the killing of a Chilean former ambassador and a U.S. citizen. It was a bombing, one of the first terrorist attacks in the United States in 1973 here in Sheridan Circle in D.C. By Pinochet regime. The point is, you know, Chile went from having, you know, Salvador Allende being democratically elected to a military coup, to having a transition after their no vote, you know, 1990, I believe, that really then led to, you know, we can get back to democracy. And the interesting thing, talking to Ambassador Valdez, who's the U.S. or the Chilean ambassador here, who's been around different times during this entire period, how essential it was to have, you know, the U.S. support, both in the time of the dictatorship, about how do you make visible what was happening in Chile on human rights and democracy, but also supporting that transition back to democracy. And so how does that, you know, look at how a country can recover and move forward? That said, I mean, if you look at Chile's current political dynamics, you know, the farther right groups, you know, the presidential candidate Kast, who was the more conservative candidate the last time around, his party's still powerful. And it's not like you don't have, you know, different views in the country, and you could go farther, you know.
We're not ones to throw stones.
I don't think anybody has like the exact solution. I do think, though, the region, in part due to, you know, widespread violence, organized criminal groups are very present in many countries and are contributing to violence. The economic fallout from COVID continues to be severe. I mean, this is the region that was most impacted by the pandemic. It's, you know, it makes up 8% of the world's population. I think it had 30% of the deaths. So, I mean, it was just, it's a region that continues to have a lot of challenges. And so when you look at those challenges, the population's response is, well, things aren't much better for me now, even with all these, you know, democratically elected governments, maybe we should try something else, which I also think you see in Argentina's case, where you're just out of sheer desperation, given how economically unstable the country is, people are willing to, you know, cast their net to somebody different and see if it may be better this time. And so it's a challenge. I think as a human rights organization, we continually work to think, how do we support organizations on the ground? How can we look at what are models, or how do you respond to get back to supporting democracy in Latin America?
And I guess that's always my fear, is like when you talk about the hyperinflation that occurred, by the way, for years in Argentina. I mean, it has been spiraling out of control for quite some time, and how that begins to rip apart the fabric of any economy. I mean, just, there is no economy that can sustain that type of sustained hyperinflation. But the willingness to just throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, okay, we'll go with somebody like Milei, or okay, we'll go with somebody like Bukele. I guess my fear in these moments is that it becomes almost like a fever, because it will. I mean, there are things that Milei is doing that may work in the short term, even if it's optics only, that it just feels like something's happening. And I think a lot of people in the United States felt that as well with the Trump administration. They just feel like, yeah, a lot of the stuff that I think I care about just suddenly is on the table, and it feels like things are moving, even though you can dig into the numbers and see it's either not moving or it's going backwards or backsliding, but democracy is eroding the entire way. And so when I think about we should probably talk about the recent troubles with Ecuador and Mexico. And you see that, you know, with that fissure right there, you see these things flare up. These are not insignificant moments. And if you add enough of them together, that's how fevers catch. And so organizations like yours, I'm sure, have an ear to the ground and look at this stuff and say, I don't like this, right? I don't like how this feels right now. And some extraordinary measures are going to have to take place to sort of right the ship. Are those discussions happening inside WOLA and with your partners on the ground? Is there a sense that there's like, okay, we need to act with a sense of urgency here because this could catch?
Yeah, I mean, I think the urgency is already there. If you're talking to partner organizations from Nicaragua, most of which are now working in exile because, you know, the Ortega regime has expelled pretty much any civil society organization, canceled the permits of thousands to operate, has, as you're probably aware, put on a plane 222 political prisoners that were being held in, you know, horrific conditions in Nicaragua on a plane to the United States, and stripped them of their nationality, which has created enormous difficulties, including for their families that are sometimes back in Nicaragua, or even for those in exile. If your passport expires, how do you get a new passport when you have a government that doesn't recognize you anymore? So I think we already have, in Nicaragua's a case, Venezuela, which is, you know, with an authoritarian government, Maduro, with elections that there was some hope could be at least competitive coming this July, end of July. I think there's still a lot of doubt of whether that will actually happen. So we've actually had a lot of exchanges now between colleagues from Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Venezuela, Argentina. What can we learn from the past? What are some best practices? How can we share experiences, but how can we also work together on shared strategies to move forward? And in that, like, what's the role of the international community, which obviously includes the United States government, which has been, you know, a very big player for good and for bad in Latin America over the decades, and others in the international community, including the European Union? How can like-minded governments in the region speak out to express concern? We've seen that particularly with Chile. At times, other governments have raised concerns about democracy or human rights in the region, depending on which country we're talking about. So it's very much part of the discussions. I think we're also aware there's enormous, you know, challenges facing the region, and that we can't any of us solve them alone. And so really the need to work much more regionally on and reflecting on what's happened in different circumstances and what's worked. What worked in Guatemala? How did you get from against all odds having you know, a democratically elected president who really has an agenda to restore rule of law, human rights, support economic development, and address, you know, in exclusion and economic inequality in that country.
I have a couple more questions. I could literally talk to you all day because I there's so much I don't know, and you're filling in so many gaps for me right now. So I'm actually going to try to rein my own head in here and come back to a couple of points that I know are important to move the migration story forward. And so that I don't actually, so I can actually let you like do your job at some point today and get back to work. The Alliance for Prosperity from 2014 seems to me that it was, so this is an Obama era policy that was sort of, seems to me to be, I guess, kind of re-engaged under Vice President Harris in the, I don't know if this is an official policy or loosely framed as the Root Causes Initiative under the Biden administration. It seems to be chaired by Vice President Harris. Is a lot of this looks to be what many advocates here on this side makes sense. Like, it's just, hey, let's, why are people coming here? It's almost like they begin to ask the right question. Okay, why are people coming here? What are the dangers that they face? Instead of always looking at it as something that is, you know, instead of hitting everything with a hammer and the whole world's a nail, like, let's go back to the root and say, okay, in this country, this is the circumstance. This is an economic situation here. It's a climate change issue here. This is a gang issue here. Let's go and address them one by one. One of my frustrations about the Biden administration is that it's almost like the first person they should have hired was a publicist in the beginning, because they did a lot of good stuff in the first couple of years that just nobody knew about. And because it was all wrapped in policy jargon and omnibus bills, and it was hard to pull apart. This seems to be one of those things where if you asked anybody who cares about immigration and thinks that that's why they're going to cast their vote one way or the other in November in the United States, and ask them, well, what do you think about the root causes policy under the Biden administration that picks up on a lot of what was happening for the Alliance for Prosperity under Barack? But they'd be like, what are you talking about? So what is this initiative? Is it working? Is it right-headed? Can you describe it for us and then let us know what the failings might be or the benefits?
Sure. And I think, you know, we should start out with the root causes strategies focused on Central America, right? Addressing migration from Central America, which is undoubtedly important. But if you're in the U.S. side of the border and you're looking at who's coming, the majority of migrants are not from Central America. I mean, 30%, a little bit over, continue to be from Mexico. And then you have everybody else, right? And I think especially it's important to think about that in the context of what we've seen in cities like New York with the high levels of Venezuelans and others coming, which are a new type of migrant in a sense, because if you look at Mexican and Central American migration, most people coming knew someone in the United States because you've had decades already of migration to the United States. So you've had this whole social support network, right? People, right. I've been at the border a lot, and you know, you talk to Central Americans and where are you going? I'm going to live with my brother in North Carolina. You had that network. You would ask Venezuelans where you're going and they had no idea. And I mean, that will change as things go forward. But I think you also just, if we look at who's come recently, particularly the Venezuelan population, which is very rapidly rising and in a short period of time, had no real connections to the United States. So that just makes it harder for them to settle because they don't have that friend, cousin, brother, any family member to stay with. And I think that's also why it's caused a lot more tax on
So before you continue on that thread, though, do you not consider the normalization or the theoretical normalization of relations with Venezuela, which might be more related to fossil fuels than anything, or our attempts to create a democracy or a more democratic election coming up. But do you not consider that part of the root causes strategy?
So, yeah, we could get to that. I think that looking at how the administration originally looked at migration from the region, it was Central America because that was the highest number at the time. It's important. I mean, no one's going to say we shouldn't address migration from Central America. I think the proposal for administration moving forward is we need to look at how do you respond to flows in a more dynamic way, because right now there's a lot of Ecuadorians coming, for example. you know, people from Colombia, other nationalities. So what, you know, what is the ability to flexibility to also address how to support countries throughout the region, given what's going on? There's a partnership, America's partnership, which is more on economic development, that's actually targeting a lot of these countries that are both in part sending countries, but are also hosting a lot of migrants. We should remember there's almost 3 million Venezuelans living in Colombia right now,
right?
1.5 in Peru. It's not like the U.S. is absorbing everybody that's on the move in the region.
Wait, Maureen, are you suggesting it's not all about us all the time? We're not the only ones impacted by this?
6.5 million Venezuelans are living in Latin America and the Caribbean.
That is 7.7 staggering.
Million. So, I mean, I think we do need to, there's a lot that the region has done to step up its efforts. Even Mexico last year, they had 141,000 asylum requests. I mean, they've certainly continuously absorbed a number of asylum seekers. The number of Nicaraguans living in Costa Rica continues to be very high. So the region's also dealing with a lot of migration flows that we should be supportive and also recognize their efforts. On the root causes strategy, I think we supported it. It is, you know, a continuation, I would say, of what was actually termed the Central America Regional Security Initiative, CARSI, during the Obama years, and then, you know, continued with level of assistance during the Trump years, although he cut it off completely for a year. He wasn't happy with what was going on, to, you know, the root causes strategy with the administration had promised up to $4 billion in assistance. I'm not sure if we'll get that, but I'm pretty sure we've had over 600 to 700 million approved every year from Congress for supporting issues in Central America regarding rule of law, justice issues, public security, poverty, food security, climate, gender-based violence, you know, a lot of the reason factors driving migration. So it's a well thought out strategy. Vice President Harris has paired that with, I think it's Partnership for Central America or Central America Partnership, which is also much more, how do you drive private sector investment into Central America with the idea of that creates more jobs? There's a lot of questioning there of how much impact it's really having, or are they well-paying jobs and also who we're working with? You have to be careful of, you know, which are we working with corrupt actors or not in terms of some of the, you know, the companies that form.
On which side, ours or theirs?
Well, I mean, in this case, you know, which companies are we partnering with in Central America? And are they, you know, free of corruption and meet sort of transparency standards? But I think overall, it's well thought out. The flip side is the U.S. can't do this alone. You have to have governments committed to it themselves in the region. So someone in the State Department once said, they have to want it as much as you do, right? So the U.S. could have a great idea. We want to support you in structural reforms. And the government's like, well, maybe not so much. I think that's part of it. You know, if you have not the right partners, I mean, let's look at Honduras, for example, which now there is, you know, more cooperation with President Xiomara Castro. The U.S. worked with former President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who has now been convicted of drug trafficking in the United States, as was his brother. So, you know, there it's complicated, too, because of who the U.S. is working with, which is why I think they're really focused a lot on supporting Benjamin Arevalo in Guatemala as the president, because it's someone they think they can build relationships with. So overall, yes, a positive strategy, a vision, I would say, for the region that's not just the root causes, but also what was originally the migration management, comprehensive migration management strategy, or collaborative migration management strategy, which was for the whole region. It pretty much is what you see in the Los Angeles Declaration for Migration and Protection that was signed at the Summit of the Americas that the U.S. hosted in June 2022 by 20 governments in the region, which is more like an integral approach to regional migration, including, you know, supporting countries of origin, transit, destination, to migration management, to protection issues, to humanitarian response. So I think the administration has a good idea. The challenge is, how do you address a situation like what we see in Haiti currently? I mean, Haitian migration has been high. The administration has, you know, appallingly deported, you know, over 20,000 more Haitians back to a country that currently, I think they've stopped, they have no airports, they can't send people back to Haiti, but to a country that has no government. So, you know, what do you do in a situation like that? Or in Venezuela, where we saw last year, the Biden administration extended temporary protective status to and redesignated it to cover more Venezuelans in the United States because the conditions on the ground are merited of a humanitarian emergency as well as persecution. Venezuela is the only country that has a investigation open at the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. There's a lot to happen in Venezuela. And I think 10 days later, the U.S. announced that it was, you know, starting to deport people to Venezuela. So, you know, I think a lot of mismatch of strategies and just the real challenges of how do you address root causes in a context where you have authoritarian governments that don't have relations with the United States, that and that there's a lot of other broader challenges to the region that, I mean, the U.S. shouldn't be the only actor involved in supporting, but does have an important role. And I think for as much as administration should put on the agenda, continually work with countries in the region, but more on these structural issues and not on how much can we support your border agencies so they can stop as many migrants as possible from crossing, you know, your border. But just to close, like for an example, Colombia. So there are, I think, as I said, 2.9 million Venezuelans in Colombia currently. The Colombian government had offered Venezuelans like a temporary 10-year protected status in the country. It's really important, but it's in part, you know, it's not sufficient. And if you look at interviews with migrants crossing through the Darien Gap, a good chunk of them actually had status in another country, in Peru, in Ecuador, in Colombia, and they couldn't make it. And that's because of discrimination, which is one thing that's happened a lot with Haitian migrants, but also just like lack of economic support. And so I think as the U.S. looks at root causes, it's also how do you support countries that are now absorbing high numbers of people so that they don't have to migrate again, because no one wants to take that journey. It's dangerous, it's costly. And you know, the U.S. shouldn't be the best destination, it isn't for everyone. So how do you really support these countries in both their own development so that their own citizens don't feel like they need to leave, but also for those that decide to stay there as migrants? And how do you ensure that they have, you know, the ability to make a living without feeling like that draw to come to the United States?
My last is more of a statement than a question that I was hoping you could kind of comment on, because I'm trying to draw out the logical conclusion and extension of this. And that is a kind of an ironic twist that the influx of migrants into the U.S. economy has actually contributed to increasing the GDP and suppressing inflation, not controlling it entirely, but suppressing the inflation, because we're leading the world in terms of inflation, even though we don't feel like it right now. We have done a much, much better job of controlling inflation in theory. A lot of thoughts on that from a different perspective. But just when we talk about migration, how that's a real double-edged sword for the Biden administration in an election year. Because if you just suddenly shut off the spigot and go, I guess, 2019 or 2020 Trump on it, you just shut everything down and you disrupt that natural flow and take a lot of people out of the growth of this system, you risk curtailing GDP a little bit, maybe contributing to inflation because that puts wage pressures on, things like that. And at the same time, with 70% of voters saying that migration and immigration is one of their top concerns all of a sudden, and I'm looking at people in Cleveland being like, is it really, like, stop? But the media has made this a circus. So that's a really interesting double-edged sword that I hadn't thought about. How do you think in DC now policymakers are looking at that instance in that moment and interpreting that in an election year?
I think there's two parts. The one is, how do you sell this more of showing that, you know, evidence demonstrates that the U.S., you know, recovery even from COVID and the, you know, the economics, we didn't go into a recession is in part due to the influx of immigrants into the country. I mean, I think there needs to be more messaging about, and this goes to the broader of the positive economic contribution that migrants, right, the majority of migrants make to the country. So how do you pair that with, I think what we're seeing more and more with candidates on both sides of, we need to be stricter at the border. And I think it seems hard to see how that's going to shift in the next few months. I mean, Biden just came out in an interview, I think yesterday, saying, you know, I'd close down the border, you know, if I was given the legal authority to do so, because it has become such a concern for the broader population. Democrats have also sort of shifted to maybe this is a, there's a lot of people here. Maybe this is a, you know, a bigger challenge for us. And so I think, unfortunately, we're going to see much more of this border security focused rhetoric in the next few months as compared to, you know, what really is needed, which is how do you create a better infrastructure at the border that is more orderly, that is more coordinated with state and local governments throughout the country and service providers of where people might be going, and that invests that the money that's really needed to have a better immigration legal system so that you don't have 3 to 5 year backlogs for any immigration case, including asylum. And so I think because none of that fits on a bumper sticker, we're going to see a lot more of the rhetoric of, you know, the we, you know, need to secure the border. We need to look at, you know, controlling the situation at the border versus, and we need to expand legal pathways for migrants and asylum seekers. I think that there's going to, as human rights and civil society organizations, we're going to keep pushing on, you know, the need to have that focus on the right to access asylum, the right to, you know, enter the country in an orderly way to, you know, request protection here. And also the fact that, you know, one, you can't really close the border, but also, you know, none of those deterrence policies and enforcement only policies have ever worked, because you have so many people that are fleeing for their lives and that are so desperate that they're willing to run the gauntlet of risks between, you know, crossing the Darien gap with threats of sexual violence, you know, the elements themselves, to getting kidnapped and extorted in Mexico and sexually assaulted. I mean, people go through extreme measures to get here because they are so desperate to save their lives and the lives of their children. And so I think we can't like lose sight of that, because you can't enforce your way out of the regional migration situation we're seeing, and that we really need to continue to look at this as a broader, more integral focus that's on legal pathways, that's focused on protection, and is also clearly focused on why people continue to feel the need to leave their countries.
The number of tributaries that we could follow, from climate change to sexual violence to human rights, social justice, mass incarceration, LGBTQ rights, marginalization, are seemingly endless, because this is a massive story. Ultimately, this is a story about humanity. This is humanity finding its place and doing it within the artificial construct of national boundaries, which is not something that is natural. Period. So these are real life issues. I'm happy to know that people like you are representing us and doing the work. I congratulate you and the folks at WOLA on your 50th anniversary. I think it's great stuff. We have on the docket for us later in the year is a piece about Mexico exclusively, and we'll obviously be following the election in Venezuela very closely. So my great hope is that you didn't have a terrible time today and that you will actually come back on the show to give us a little bit more perspective when those things come up. But for today, I just wanted to thank you for your time, for your insight, and I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hang tight.